Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with the industry's biggest names. I'm your host, Alan Seals, and our guest today is playwright Dave Harris, who, if there was a theater podcast 30 under 30, this dude would be on it. He has so much talent in his fingertips, and he just puts them down on paper, digitally, of course, and writes these incredibly amazing scripts. He's got two things that are being produced simultaneously right now on both coasts. So he's flying back and forth between LA and New York almost every other night because they're both opening at the same time. This is insane. He talks about that when we get going. And it's really fun because the conversation we got into, he was talking about how he uses his writing to seemingly work through fear on an unconscious level. And I think it's his own form of therapy, right? Although consciously, he's always trying to improve himself, which is, of course, something we all should be trying to do. He has this incredibly funny fear of birds. He tells a story as to why. So he started reading up on birds to try to get over his fear and now ends up loving bird watching, but he still has his fear of birds. So he likes to bird watch with a fear of birds. It's kind of funny. Before we get into the interview, please find me on Instagram and Twitter at @theater_podcast, on TikTok at @TheTheaterPodcast. I'm Tiki Talking. It's kind of fun. I don't know. Let me comment there. Let me know you're there. And we're going to take a short break and then get into the episode. Enjoy this interview with Dave Harris.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Here you go, 1, 2, 3.
Today's guest is a poet, performer, and playwright whose recent work includes Tambo and Bones and Exception to the Rule. He's a Tau Foundation playwright in residence at Roundabout Theater Company and has published a full-length collection of poetry called Patricide. And ever since I first discovered this dude, he has been on my list of people whose stories I cannot miss. Dave Harris, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And I know we were just chatting before we started recording that you landed from LA last night around 10 p.m. Eastern, and now we're recording on the next morning. Why are you flying back and forth?
Yes, it's a very chaotic and exciting time right now. I have Exception to the Rule in previews right now at Roundabout, and mm-hmm. Tambo and Bones in previews right now at Center Theater Group in LA. So I'm going back and forth to help them both open as possible. So I was in LA. I left to go to LA on Monday, came back to New York today, leave again to go back to LA on Saturday, and come back again to New York on Monday, just trying to get to both of these openings and, you know, give my notes and do all that good stuff. But yeah, it's a crazy time. It's a crazy time.
Exception to the Rule was supposed to open a while ago, right? The original plan wasn't to have these at the same time?
No, it was not. I was living in San Diego, finishing up grad school, and Exception to the Rule was supposed to start rehearsals in March 2020. And I was 2 weeks from moving to New York to live here. And then Exception to the Rule got postponed. And then Tambo and Bones was supposed to happen at Polaris Horizons in November 2020. And then that got postponed. And then we were in like a 2-year limbo. And now finally, they're all happening. But of course, they're all back to back to back. So, you know, I just get the constant wave of going from show to show right now, which is super fun. And also, I am so tired.
and you are, God, you are young, man. Like, you are just out of, like you say, you just got out of grad school. And now these two shows happening simultaneously, two amazing shows, right? And then you have your fully published book of poetry, your full length book, and all of a sudden, I mean, I guess we'll get back into the childhood in a second, but for the things that are happening now, the two shows and the poetry book, how long ago did you start working on these? And did, were they recent things? Did you craft them in grad school or undergrad? I mean, because you got your BA from Yale. We'll get into that. But like, hot damn, right? Like, seems like you've been working your ass off for how long now to all of a sudden have this come, all of these things happen at once?
I mean, you know, everything, every project takes a long develop, you know, like with playwriting, you can really get caught in the development hell, especially when you're starting off with just going to sort of every new play conference and work with, and they're all great. Like, I've met some of like the best collaborators of my life through those things. But each of these plays has been in development for a while and just, and has been like lined up and ready to go for a long time too. Like Miranda and I did our first reading of this play, Miranda Heyman, who's directing the show at Roundabout, who's a brilliant artist. Directed the first reading of this play in New York in, I guess this was January 2019 and the 2018, something like that. So, you know, we've been working together on this for a long time and finally it's coming to fruition. And Tambo and Bones started as a one act that then Amrita Ramanan, from when she was working at Oregon Shakespeare Fest, was like, oh, come develop this here. And then, you know, we'll like fly you out and you can work on the actors here. So, you know, everything takes a long process and then finally you get to see it on stage. And it's up for 2 months and then it's over. So you really kind of get, but you get in the weeds of them for a long time. So it's they're all things that I've been like working on and honing for a very long time. And I'm really fortunate that people are responding to them because, you know, I write them for myself and then it's a good coincidence that people like them too.
Well, okay, then you write them for yourself. So let's start out Little Dave, right? Born in West Philly, and I'm resisting all of the urge to do the jokes about Fresh Prince of Bel Air here, but
it gets even worse because I was born in Los Angeles and then moved to Philly, so there's like reverse Fresh Prince trajectory happening here.
you gotta write your own parody intro song for you know, like just the reverse of what Will Smith did, or yeah. But okay, so you grew up in West Philadelphia.
Like Chris Rock too.
Yeah, so you weren't born there, but raised in West Philadelphia, and on the playground, you did not spend most of your days. But so when you were young, were you attracted to theater, or was it musical theater? Was like what kind of stories? Because I'm always so curious how playwrights get into playwriting, simply because the ability to craft a book is such a different process than writing lyrics or writing instrumentals.
Yeah, no, everything sort of come from a different place. I've been writing in some shape or form my entire life. Like my mom, when I was in second grade, called that I was going to be a writer. And I was like, no, you're not. No, I'm not. You're wrong. And of course she was right. But she did the same thing with my sister too. She called that my sister was going to be an elementary school teacher. And my sister was like, no, I'm not. I'm going to be a chef. And now she teaches second grade. So, you know, my mom just kind of prophesied the whole thing.
But she teaches graders how to cook. So that, you know, it all comes full circle.
It all comes full circle. But so I've been writing in one form or another my whole life. I started in short stories when I was in elementary school. My mom let me read Stephen King in an age when I really should not have been reading Stephen King. That sort of, I would write just these demented ass stories. And that's when I started doing theater too. I started doing theater in elementary school also. In sixth grade, I switched schools from a public school to a private school. All boys, old money, almost entirely white until my year when they dropped five of us into the school. Whole hot mess. A lot of my writing comes from that split that happened in that place. In seventh grade, two things happened. The first was that I realized I didn't have, all my friends were dudes. And then that day I saw an audition posting for come audition for the school play at the Baldwin Girls School. And I was like, oh my God, that's the key. It's in the most sort of prepubescent phase of my life. I was like, oh my God, now's the time. And the second thing that happened was that there was this group called Philadelphia Young Playwrights that a lot of Philly playwrights came through. Like Kiara Hudez came up through Philadelphia Young Playwrights and was part of it. And as part of my school's curriculum, we had to write and submit a play to the contest. I wrote a play that got second place in the contest. And then from that, ends up in that organization. So I was writing plays all throughout middle school and high school. Went to college not expecting it to be a thing because no one in my family had done the 4-year college thing. So I was like, if I go, I have to do something that sounds legit. And then 2 years into it. So I went and think I was going to major in the hard sciences. And then 2 years into college, had a teacher, had a theater teacher who kind of slapped me upside the head and was like, you're lying to yourself. And I was like, you're right. And then have just been writing since, pretty much exclusively for, I mean, I've done like a lot of other things in between there, but everything's been geared towards writing and producing this material.
Oh my goodness. So much I want to cover. So first of your family to go to college, to do the 4 year college thing, you said, and then you go to Yale of all places. But I want to back up. We'll back up from Yale. We'll get to Yale. But, you were saying, I was going to ask about the, I guess, what should we call it? Racial disparity of what you were saying in sixth grade, right? You went to sixth or seventh grade, right?
Yeah.
You went to this school, so, and there were only five, it was five people of color. You say you were one of five people of color who got dropped into this pretty much all white school, or was it literally all white?
Essentially, the sixth grade, it's, you know, you were in a transition from middle school, from lower school to middle school, and the school runs from pre-K to high school. And, you know, I think sixth grade, there was an optics problem. So their solution was to go find five, like, gifted Black students, sort of drop us into the school with no guidance and anything at all. And, you know, none of us had access to a world that looked the way it did. You know, this is like old money, you know, I've met rich people. And I still, I'm just like, y'all, this is nuts. and so that's where all my understanding of theater comes from. I think it's from the sort of like learning how to perform in that space and like sort of seeing how much of class and race is just based around performance and just based around like how can you scheme in this world. So anyway, that's how I ended up in that school. I think that's a large part of how I ended up in theater and thinking through kind of performance theory and what it is to embody yourself or what it is to have like a true self, whether that exists or not, comes from, I think, that split of going to that school.
I'm fascinated by all of this, and I will be the first to admit, I mean, I acknowledge white privilege and male privilege and being a straight white male, like certain things come with that until recently I didn't realize that just came because of literally my outward appearance that I have no control over. And now, especially in New York and all over the world with anti-Asian hate, it's Black Lives Matter and everything that's been happening, like, hot damn, I don't need to make this a political episode, but it seems to me like there is so much, racial reckoning, right? There's an awakening that has been exposed. And I won't say has been created. It's not new. It's always been there. And I love that voices like yourself are writing about things that are going mainstream. They need to be mainstream. They need to be more in the front of people's minds. And I love that this experience that you've had, right? This experience that is personal to you, you're writing it for yourself because I assume it's a form of catharsis, right? But then it's also, like you said, it's something that other people want to hear and then all of a sudden you get produced and you get recognized because you're writing great stories. So there's two sides of this. One is the natural talent you've probably got as a writer. And then the other is drawing from these personal stories. People always say, write what you know. So has your perception of what you've been writing been able to change over time as the culture has been shifting and I guess like going into theater is even old money and old white money at that, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't think the that I would probably raise is that I actually don't think the culture is shifting. I think every there's always consistent waves of discovery and something. It's like we just find new language to describe the same exact phenomenon over and over again. And functionally for me, I mean, this is why I sometimes become really frustrated with theater and with playwriting, with the field often, is that I think so much of kind of the language of the moment is functionally just a distraction. You know, like for me, the reason why I write is not to address something external. Like, you know, all the language around race and class and everything, it's very consequential, but also is functionally just like a distraction from the things I actually want to write about, you know? And so for me, it's normally just a way to get into something, some existential fear that I have beneath that, you know? And that for me is what is most important, but I think that's also a thing that can distract you from the work. But because ultimately the only thing, this is the thing that I think I've fallen from in my whole career is that, you know, I think I write very much from an individual perspective in a culture that I think very much wants to uphold an idea of community, you know? Like a Stepping Stone Rule is very much about there are six Black teenagers stuck in a room. There's one Black teenager who maybe has the capacity to escape the room and the other five who are stuck. It's about what's the cost of staying with the group versus leaving to go do whatever awaits you outside, you know? And I think like all of my playwriting is geared around this idea of how do you escape into what it is to what your own individual imagination is. And so the task for me as a writer is how, amidst a culture that claims to be shifting but ultimately never is, how do I stay loyal to my own imagination and keep writing through that?
I don't even know how to add on to that. That is such a deep level of understanding. And so, exception to the rule, you said it's six Black teenagers in a room. The room is detention, so it adds that extra level of stress. And there's five people who are regulars there, and then the new girl comes in, and she's. It sounds to me like even though outwardly she is like the other people in the world, internally she's facing the same struggles that you were literally just talking about with yourself of like maintaining, how do you justify moving ahead and leaving others behind while still wanting to be part of like the larger group? And so what you said though, you want to write about what you want to write about and you're struggling with that. What do you want to write about?
Oh, I want to write about everything I am writing about, you know? I feel very grateful because I think all of playwriting very much comes from my understanding of poetry, and the way that poetry was taught to me was that basically I went to this poetry workshop called Callaloo, where this poet, Greg Pardlow, you basically sit in a room with 10 other poets and you read him your poem. He reads your poem back to you, and then he's like, this line is a lie, this line is a lie, this line is a lie, this line is kind of true, this line you're maybe trying to say something, tell me about your father. And then you basically just use your own words to like catalyze you into pushing beneath to find the thing you're actually scared of saying, beneath the distractions of what you're doing on the page. And so playwriting for me is usually how do I keep finding a way to question a fear I have or a truth that I've settled on. So every play for me is addressing that in some way. It's addressing some very personal fear that I have, and hopefully trying to find a fun way to do that. So acceptance of the rule. That's why I almost tend to always write in comedies. Is that for me? It's like, how do I find a fun way to interrogate this fear? So everything that I've gotten to write are the things that I've always dreamed about writing. You know, Tambo and Bones, I got to put an entire rap concert on stage, you know, like like that. And that's the thrill for me. It's like, how do I do something that I've never seen? How do I continue to surprise myself? And if I can surprise myself, then I think I can surprise an audience. So I feel very fortunate that like I've everything I've written has been exactly in line with what I want to write, you know?
And getting recognized, and it's getting produced, and I think that's sort of takes to the Tao Foundation playwright in residence. Mm-hmm. So you're playwright in residence at Roundabout Theater. So for those who don't know, the Tao Foundation. Let's see, it's a residency program. I guess. Well, first of all, explain what the Tao Foundation is.
Yeah. So the Tao Foundation does a lot of things. Essentially, I had an interesting trajectory with them because normally what they do is they help you, they give you money and help you become a part of the theater that you're working at. But I was Tao playwright in residence when I actually couldn't be in residence in New York because of the pandemic. So they basically just like helped, but like sort of like funded me through the pandemic and also helped make sure that this play stayed available to produce, basically. You know, like they really are just like, how can we support artists through a time in a play, in a city, in a time when it's hard to be an artist, you know? And I think that looks different for every playwright because, you know, there's Tao playwrights and residents at many theaters. they sort of just support people when they're in production in their place. So I'm Emily Tao and Falco Edition sort of just like really helped me through the pandemic and helped make writing a sustainable thing through that time. And now finally it all gets to come to fruition when we finally get to do this play.
Well, I mean, the residency program includes, it's a full-time salary and funds to support the work and guaranteed full production of the play by the sponsoring theater company. And it seems like this is not an easy thing to become a part of. So what was the application process like to even get this?
It's not as exciting as it could be. Essentially, the theater agrees to produce the play, and then through the theater, you apply to the Tao Foundation. And then they select maybe seven playwrights and seven plays at theaters in New York, and sort of just like sponsor this residency, which, you know, it's sort of like typical grant writing process, which the weeds of that are not that exciting.
it sounds really competitive. I mean, just to basically get a free production for your show, for your script, it sounds like it's super hard. And for whatever reason in my mind when you were telling the story, I was thinking, I'm halfway through season three of Ozark, and I don't know if you ever watch Ozark, but the end of season two, spoiler alert, there's one of the kids gets accepted to college because he writes this really profound essay and whatnot, and I'm always thinking about writers when it comes to TV and film and these things, because there's some of the best monologues and dialogue and scenes and whatnot that you see on screen. I mean, there's great ones on stage as well. And right now you're young in your career. You're really like getting shot out of this cannon and having two plays produced simultaneously, which is incredible. Hopefully both of them come to Broadway, knock on wood. And At the same time, have you had any opportunities then to sort of showcase the same sort of skills for movies, for TV? Is that of any interest to you at all, to sort of like to do any of that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing that for a while. For the last, when did I really start? I guess 2019 was when I really started getting into film and TV. The first project I worked on was this film called Summertime, directed by Carlos Lopez Estrada, who's brilliant director. He just did Raya and the Last Dragon. He's sort of like, and we did this kind of very small project that was based around these youth spoken word poets in Los Angeles. And that was my first feature writing gig. It was like another thing where we just got thrown into the weeds sort of immediately. Like we had 3 months to outline, rehearse, write, and shoot the movie. And then ended up like going to opening at Sundance the following winter. And that was like another one where just like jumped into it immediately, got to learn everything very quickly. And then ever since then, I've been working on, I have a couple different feature projects. I write for TV too, but screenwriting has been more, there's more flexibility with that. You know, like it's, if I was in a writer's room right now, I couldn't be doing this interview right now, because I would be in the room this second, you know, and I couldn't be in rehearsal. Whereas screenwriting, you know, I can come home from rehearsal, be tired as hell, drinking a glass of wine, and like open final draft. And that sort of flexibility is like what's letting me do that and theater at the same time. In the pandemic in particular, when theater shut down, I compartmentalized all my grief by jumping really heavily into film and TV. And now I go between all three.
Do you have a favorite medium? And then also, are you somebody who is able to do multiple things at once like this, to jump to context switch and go between things, or do you have to focus on one thing at once?
No, I'm at my happiest when I get to go between multiple things. I actually, every time a show opens and I go home, I'm usually like depressed for a week, because I'm just like, I don't know what to do with my time, because rehearsal is so intense. Like, I think that's, I learned that during Tambo and Bones, I think particularly with Omicron, and so we were so scared of getting shut down. Like everything, it's so intense, and then the show opens, and then you're just done, and you're not there anymore, and you're just like, oh, what do I do with my body? Like, I don't know how to, you know, like last, I left New York to go back to LA, to go back home after Tambo and Bones opened. I like went home, and I just played Elden Ring, a video game, for like a week straight. You know, I was just like, I don't know what to do right now. When I'm moving between different projects, that's when I think I'm at my best, my most stressed, but also my happy place.
That's really interesting. I I have talked to some people who are like, I can't do more than one thing at once. And I feel like, though, it you have to go where the creativity goes. And especially in now the 20 minutes that we've been talking here, it seems like, you know, you're somebody, you've gone to writing and you're successful at writing because whether you're consciously doing it or not, you're using the outlet to express yourself. And you've talked about expressing grief and expressing and dealing with feelings and getting over fear and things that a lot of people go their entire lives without ultimately being able to do in one form or another. And it seems to me that the different stories that go along with the different mediums are always going to be changing. So you might have like a happy rom-com that you're writing for TV that's like, okay, that's a paycheck. But then like there's something that doesn't pay hardly anything, but it for theater that's really going to help you get over this great fear or grief or whatever the case is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a large part of what, how I ended up here. Like one of the biggest gifts of writing, I think, comes from the fact that I think there's such a dearth of, it was often felt like a dearth of language in my family and growing up, because things would happen so quickly and everything was so focused on survival and getting to the next day that infrequently was there time to sit and process anything. And I think that's what writing has gifted me, is that like I get to just sit and find language for things that are just patterns that we grew up with, you know, things that we just sort of accepted as habit, or that's just the state of living. And now I get to just assign words to it. And once I do that, then I feel like I can get control of a thing that I felt like I didn't have control over. And I think that's the thing you just talked about is what keeps me writing. And it might not be that way forever. You know, like 10 years from now, I could be like, all right, I'm done writing. I want to go be a bird watcher, which honestly, I fucking love birds. Like, I have a really complicated relationship with birds, because I'm also really, I have a really bad bird phobia. Like, it's not cute. And also, like, I love bird watching. so I don't know. Maybe 10 years from now, I'll be like, all right, I'm retired from the game. And now I just go observe mannequins in the wild or something. Who knows? But for now, this is the fun thing.
You sound like such a walking paradox. you want a bird watch, but you hate birds. Where'd your bird phobia come from?
Attacked by a flock of geese when I was 4 years old and never bounced back.
What? Why do geese attack?
Okay, so geese are terrible. They pose no danger, but they have like a high intimidation factor, and like it works really well in their face. Like, you know, that's why like they honk and stuff. Like, but when I was 4 years old, my mom and I went to this. We would go to this pond and like feed them stale bread and like stale hot dog buns. My mom was like laying back and letting me do it on my own. And I was like, yeah, I'm grown. I can do this. Geese surrounded me. I was like, oh shit, I'm in danger. I take off running. I'm crying, but my dumbass is still holding the bag of hot dog buns. So they're like flying after me. And my mom is watching the whole thing and she's laughing too hard to come save me. Like the thing I remember is like the geese wing flapping and like the sound of my mom's laughter. And I was like, bam, trauma, it's done.
And that one experience has shaped who you are for the rest of your life, which is so interesting.
I tell you, I've gone on dates and there's been like a flock of pigeons on the side of the street. I'm just like, nah, we got to cross the street. I can't walk through these birds with you. Like 3 years ago, I was like, let me get to the bottom of this. So I started reading a lot of ornithology books and I was like, oh my God, birds are crazy. Like I have like bird tattoos. Like I love it. But also like if a bird comes near me, like I will hit the ground. Like it's not, I thought learning about it would give me control over it. And that I would say that has not worked.
My sister-in-law has a phobia of butterflies. So like geese, I can sort of understand because they're like big, they flap, they honk. Butterflies, I have never understood because they are the nicest, most gentle creatures that you can think of.
I get it. I feel for your sister. You know, I think it's something about wings. Like they can come at you from any angle. It's you can't see them coming necessarily. It's I get it.
We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode. Have you ever put something down on paper or even like written something on paper or even got it to the stage, put it on its feet and not completely understanding why it was written or why you took something to a certain place, a scene to a certain place, and then after you can watch it, you're hearing somebody else read it or seeing it on its feet, and you're like, oh, that's why I needed to talk about that.
Yes. Yeah, all the time. I think that came through especially with poetry. I would write something and have no idea what I was trying to write about. And then I would show it to someone and they would be like, oh, this poem was about this. And I was like, oh, word? I thought it was just about birds. Or I thought this was just about like honeybees, you know? And they're like, nah, 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 nah. You're trying to get over like that one relationship that broke your heart. You're trying to say the thing to your mother you've never actually said out loud. And I was like, nah, this poem's about birds, you know. it all sort of so much subconscious things that go into feelings and language. And you know, like if I were to sit down and do a free write right now and like show it to someone, they'd be like, "Hey, are you thinking about this right now?" And I would be like, "Oh, I didn't even realize," you know. And that came through often in poetry. I really miss it. I haven't written a poem in a while just because theater and film and TV stuff has gotten kind of crazy, but I really miss it for that feeling.
That's so much fun. I've always held myself back from writing, and because I'm afraid of the judgment, right? Because you're putting your inner thoughts down on paper, and sometimes they're pretty deep. But then the other part is just figuring out what you want to write about, and I guess that's where, you know, people talk about journaling, like just journal every day, write something down every day, just start writing and see where it goes. Sometimes it's incoherent, sometimes you get something great. And I should follow that advice, because part of what, like I was saying, what's holding me back from writing over time was simply because I didn't know what to write about. And I wanted to be specific and I wanted it to come out profound and prolific and life-changing. Mm. And sometimes what anybody writes is crap, and you just got to take the good with the bad. Right? I mean, do you judge yourself? Are you the harshest judge of yourself, or you just give no shits and you're just like, all right, I'm just going to write down whatever comes out of my head?
That's a good question. I don't know how. This is a good question, because when you ask it, I'm like, oh, I don't feel like I have an answer at the ready, because I don't really judge my own writing that harshly until it's done or until I'm rewriting. And I don't know where that comes from, you know? I feel with it, because normally it's once I start writing, it just like comes and goes. Like I can sit and just do it for 8 hours. I'm not a write every day person, just because the space that I want to access when I write is not a space that I want to live in all the time, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I don't do it every day for that reason. I think it's just like that boundary is important to me. But when I am sitting down to do it, I don't feel that in my head or that judgmental of it until I'm rewriting. And then until I'm rewriting, I'm just like, oh, that line doesn't make sense. You know, then I can really get into the weeds. But the act of it itself is usually, I don't know. It stays fun. It's always stayed fun, you know. And I hope that fun continues. And when it doesn't, then I'll figure out what the next thing is that feels as fun as writing. But I don't know what that is yet. So I'm still doing it.
A therapist who specializes in bird phobias, obviously, you know, do therapy in what you know.
Yo, so, I've tried exposure therapy. I've tried. I'm gonna like run through. It doesn't stick.
I'm always curious and fascinated. When you mentioned Stephen King, right? Like you're reading Stephen King at an age that you're too young to read Stephen King, And like that dude is known for horror. They're obviously like inside our minds are some, on a general basis, inside everyone's minds are some of the scariest, probably nastiest, horrible places that you can be for the most part. And that's why inner thoughts stay inner thoughts. But you've got these writers like Stephen King who are just writing nothing but horror. And there are some really, really great TV shows and movies and scripts and, stage scripts that are based, some in fact, so that's easier to say, oh, based on a true story, but some completely made up that are just kind of really horrible, horrible stories. And, you know, whatever your definition of horrible is. But, and again, going back to the feeling of being judged or feeling, I guess, scrutinized, right? Like, if you're known for being this person who writes just really uncomfortable thing or makes people feel uncomfortable, I guess, how do you find that comfortability level or the acceptance with yourself to be able to say, like, you know what? I'm putting this out there. Because it's one thing to put something out there in the world and have a bunch of strangers look at it that are never going to talk to you and that you're never going to meet. But then you've got your mom, your sister, your friend, your close friends, your partner, whoever it is, who have to know that you've got these really sick thoughts inside. You know what I mean?
I do. I hear you. I think just it would be otherwise, you know? Like, because it's otherwise, I'm really excited for Acceptance to the Rules to open because it's formally very different from Tambo and Bones. And I think every single one of my plays is formally very different from the last play. And it's because, you know, I think there's a school of playwriting of playwrights who are drawn to doing a certain thing and they hone that thing over and over again. And like in every play they write, you can see the thing they're after, you know, like I think like, and it's brilliant, you know, like Sam Hunter and like Dominic Morisseau, you know, like they're formally are engaged with often with similar shapes of plays, you know, or similar regions or similar areas. And then I think there's kind of like Julia Cho, like Anne Washburn, like the playwrights who like every play they write is a completely different shape. And that's the thing that excites me as a writer, you know, and that's, I think, why like people will come say Acceptance to the Rule, which is a kind of a single set, six actors on a stage, just like having a feast, acting their asses off play. And now that play is there, I won't ever write another play like that, you know? And that's the fun part for me. So like this thing about like, oh, how do you keep putting something out there? I think for me, it's like, oh, once I figure out how to say something, I never have to say it again. And that for me, I think pushes me through. And also because like, you can't let other people outwrite you. Like if other people are going to a place, I'm like, all right, bet I got to find the next place, you know? And that's the, like, you know, like I sometimes wish playwriting worked more like hip hop, where it's like, oh, we could write diss tracks, or we could be like, oh, okay, cool, cool, cool. You did that. Bet. Okay. I'm going to beat this flow with this. Or we can like respond to each other in our work. I think that happens, you know, passively, but I would be really excited about a theatrical community where we really did that. But that's another wormhole.
Oh, man. I would love for you to write a loose script that incorporates some sort of audience feedback with looping technology. So you're telling a story that's slightly different every night, and maybe it's a one or a two-person show, and using the looping, you can bring old parts of the script back to play with yourself as another character. There you go. There's your multi-million dollar.
There it is. Drop it in the bucket.
There you go.
Yeah. Tambo and Bones was similar. It was like every night was different with that show, which was part of the joy of it.
Oh yeah, I wish I could see it. I need to go out to LA actually. And I'm overdue for a West
Coast
trip.
Yeah, come through.
Your website is staydancingdave.com. Where's the dancing come from?
I've just always been a dancer my whole life. And I think that's one where I was like, oh, freshman year of college, somebody said that. Cause I was doing something. I think I was like, doing bachata or something. And that name kind of stuck and I was like, oh, okay, cool. That'll be my brand. You know, you know, like first day of college, you're just like, oh, who am I going to be here? And then I'm just like, ah, that's who it is. It stayed true. You know, one of the hardest things about COVID was that there was no, communal dance. There's no communal dance. You know, I would go to like, I went to a Zoom bachata dance and it was so sad. We were all so sad. We're just like in front of our cameras, just like, you know, there was a DJ who was like shouting out people's Zoom screens. I was like, this can't be the world.
Like aliens come and look at this history tape. It's like, why are all these people staring at random representations of electrons turning on and off? Like they're literally, there's nobody in the room with you. You are all by yourself. And like, I'm literally talking to a bunch of metal with it's being lit up by electrons right now. Right. So I think about that all the time when I'm just like working on the computer, just, oh God, how far we've come and how so far we've got to go. Oh, man. All right.
The void. We're in the void.
We're in the void. All right. So let's wrap up with three standard closing questions that I ask everybody to end the episodes. The first one, just very simply, is what motivates you?
Friends' imaginations.
Your friends' imaginations or yours?
Yeah. No, my friends. I feel like my friends are the greatest artists in the world, and I feel honored to be their friends, you know? And like every time I get to read something there, by everything I get to like witness their artistry at work, I'm just like the I went to Sanaz Tusi is like the homie, and like I love her dearly. And every time I get to see one of her plays, I'm just like, oh yeah, cool. I'm like, I hate theater so much. And then I go see her plays, I'm just like, oh my God, no, it's such a gift to be alive writing when you are. And like I saw my friend Amara in For Color Girls on Broadway. She came on stage and I was like, Am I crying watching you on stage? Just like be yourself. You know, and I'm just like, oh, yeah, of course. That's the greatest reason to keep doing this, is that the people we love are doing it too.
Mm. All right. What advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path?
The advice I'll give to my younger self, fight back against those fucking geese. if I would have thrown hands with the first goose that flew at me, I would not have this phobia today. But I ran. And set me on a path of life that could have been redeemed much easier, much more easily. So that's my advice.
What about younger people starting out down a similar path?
Who don't have
a bird phobia?
I would say that build a body of work before you spend your life trying to hone one piece of art. I think for me, I wrote plays pretty much my whole life at this point. And the most useful thing was having multiple plays that were vastly different from each other than sort of like spending years in the lab with one play and hoping that was the one that would get me through. Like, you know, the play that I've won the most awards for has never been produced, you know. It's a play called White History. I don't think it might never be produced, but it opened the door such that then I could like then slide in three more plays.
That's so cool. All right. Last question. If you can only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Maybe this is just because it's on my mind right now, but The Skin of Our Teeth on Broadway.
All right. Yeah. So you've got your website, staydancingdave.com. Where else can we find you online?
Instagram, Twitter, all the things at staydancingdave. You can find me in the theater at Roundabout, Exception to the Rule, until the end of June, or in the theater in LA at Center Theater Group until the end of May.
All right. You can get more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at @theater_podcast. I'm on Twitter. I mean, TikTok now at The Theater Podcast. I don't know what I'm doing on TikTok. This has been edited by Well Ren Hoodlum Productions. Thank you to Jukebox the Ghost for the intro and outro and music. And Dave Harris, thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
Yeah, this is fun. Thanks for having me.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.